In our study of the history of missions, we come now to the great century. The great century of missions extends from 1792 through 1914. Sometimes this is referred to as the 19th century. You say, well, the 19th century, isn't that from 1800 to 1900? Well, why do we talk about 1792 and 1914? 1792 is the year that marks the birth of modern missions. We associate it with the name of William Carey. He is often called the father of modern missions. In our previous study of the history of missions, we have come across other models of Protestant missions. The Danish Holly Mission, for example, or the Moravian Mission. But these models of missions were not reproducible. They were unique. They belonged only to their particular historical circumstances. You can't very well reproduce a mission that depends on the funds and the goodwill of the King of Denmark on one hand and the graduates of the University of Halle in Germany on the other hand. It's not a reproducible pattern. And the Moravian pattern was also unique because it was a missionary community. Moravian missionaries were sent out from this community. They were given a one-way ticket. There were no furloughs. They were tradespeople who were expected to go to the country to which they were sent and establish businesses and to earn their living. In fact, there is a book about Moravian missions called A Prophet for the Lord, P-R-O-F-I-T, that they sought to establish businesses and then of the converts that they made, teach them trades and really become effective in evangelism by working side by side with the people in the country to which they went. So there was a uniqueness about Moravian missions that could not be reproduced easily. And because, as we had previously learned, Luther had shut down the monasteries and there was no monastic movement within Protestantism, Protestantism had no missionary structures that were reproducible, and therefore they had no mechanism to send missionaries. Even when a missionary consciousness or a sense of oughtness about missions arose within the Protestant community. It was William Carey who changed all of that. The year 1914, or the other end of the great century of missions, is a year that we identify with the outbreak of the First World War. Between 1792 and 1914, there was a tremendous optimism about missions, about progress all over the world. People felt that the world was getting better. Scientific progress, medical progress, educational progress. They felt that civilization, as it was understood by Europeans, was spreading throughout the world, and there was just a great deal of optimism. And Western nations prided themselves on being models for the world as Christian nations. But what happened in 1914? The First World War came along, and suddenly the Christian nations produced the most murderous war in history. And the prestige of Western civilization, as identified with Christian civilization, was shattered in the minds of many people around the world. And so there was a whole new attitude in the world, an increasing pessimism that has characterized the 20th century. So this period, this 19th century, this great century in missions, when we talk about that, we're talking about the events from 1792 through 1914. You have a diagram before you. And as we seek to understand this period, you'll notice that there are a number of very important events that are highlighted. But there are two ways of looking at this period of time. One of those follows the modified chronological approach and refers to the great century, 1792 through 1914, and then advanced through storm, the modern period, where in spite of obstacles, the missionary advance of the church has taken place. And during these next couple of sessions, we're going to be following that understanding of missions. That's the way we're going to look at this period of time. Another way of looking at it is to divide this period of time from 1792 until today into three eras based primarily on the strategy that was employed in missions. And we'll take a look at that after we have reviewed the events chronologically. Let's focus on William Carey, the father of modern missions. What kind of person was he? Well, he was born in 1761. When he was 14 years of age, he apprenticed himself to a shoemaker. He was converted at the age of 18, and he left the Church of England and became a Baptist. At 26, he was ordained into the Baptist ministry. But he was never a full-time preacher. In fact, he earned his living by mending shoes. He was a shoemaker, and he taught school and preached on Sunday. In his spare time, he devoured every book he could lay his hands on. It was from his father and his grandfather, both of whom were schoolmasters, that he inherited his passion for learning. He taught himself Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Italian, French, and Dutch. And he denied that he was a genius. He said, I'm just a plodder. It was reading The Last Voyages of Captain Cook that first aroused in him an interest in missionary work. And after that, he began to read every book that he could get his hands on that had any bearing on the outside world. He read Guthrie's Geographical Grammar. He read Jonathan Edwards' The Life and Diary of David Brainerd. He became familiar with the Danish Holly Mission. He learned about John Eliot in New England. He learned all about the Moravian missionaries. And he even had a map made out of leather in his shoe shop, his shoe repair shop, his cobbler shop, in which he inscribed on that, in the leather of that map, all the information that he could gather from all the books that he was reading about the different countries in the world. So you can just picture this village shoemaker, this part-time preacher there in his leather apron, his books by his side, his map on the wall, and flowers in the window. In 1792, he wrote a book. The book is probably as important to the history of missions as Luther's 95 Theses out of the history of theology. It was only 87 pages. Why, we have master's theses in the library here, which are longer than that. Just 87 pages, and yet it changed the world. Back in those days, they used to give long titles to books. And so you hardly had to read the book. All you had to do was read the title, and you knew it was in the book. Now, this one was called An Enquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens. Wow, what a long title. You have a title like that, you don't even need subtitles. Well, the most important part of that was the phrase, to use means. That's the that you want to remember. To use means for the conversion of the heathen. This landmark book was immediately controversial because at that time, almost all of the Baptists were Calvinists, and they believed very strongly in predestination. And many of them had the idea, why bother with missions? Why use human means? I mean, God predestines those he would save to be saved, and those he either passes over the others or he predestines them to damnation. And we have nothing to do with it. And so when he said we must use means for the conversion of the heathen, it sounded to them like heresy. And so he stood up. He wanted to talk about missions at a ministerial meeting among the Baptist ministers, and he suggested that they discuss the implications of the Great Commission. And Dr. John Ryland stood up, and he said to Carey, he said, young man, sit down. When God wants to convert the heathen, he'll do it without your help
or mine.
See, they had carried their belief in the sovereignty of God to an extreme and didn't see the value of using human means or a vehicle that God had ordained to use people for the carrying out of the Great Commission. So Carey was facing an uphill battle. But he continued on. And on May 30th, 1792, at a Baptist Ministers Association in Nottingham, he preached a famous sermon that became the Magna Carta of the missionary movement. It's found in, the text is in Isaiah 54, verses 2 and 3. Enlarge the place of your tent, stretch your tent curtains wide, do not hold back, lengthen your cords, strengthen your stakes, for you will spread out to the right and to the left. Your descendants will dispossess nations and settle in their desolate cities. And he concluded with the famous words, which became a maxim or a motto, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. Well, that sermon really touched the hearers. The following day, he pled for immediate action, but his followers faltered. And he continued to insist on missions. And finally, he persuaded them to include in the minutes, the Baptist Association to include in the minutes, that they would present a definite plan for the formation of the Baptist Society for propagating the gospel among the heathen. And this meeting took place in October 2nd in Andrew Fuller's chapel in Kettering. In the evening, there was a small group of 12 ministers and one layman who were gathered with William Carey in the spacious home of Widow Wallace, known for her hospitality. And this place was known as the Gospel Inn. Again, Carey pressed for action. And again, the brethren wavered. After all, who were these people? They were all ministers of poverty-stricken churches. Few of them were supported by the offerings of the people because the people were so poor. And here they were to undertake a mission. Nobody done it before. All these difficulties, all these obstacles, so much uncertainty. And so their hope dimmed. They really didn't believe that they could do it. At that point, Carey reached into his pocket and he pulled out a booklet which was entitled Periodical Accounts of Moravian Missions. And with tears in his eyes and a tremor in his voice, he said, if only you had read this, and if only you knew how these men overcame all obstacles for Christ's sake, you'd go forward in faith. Well, that was it. They organized. And the mission began to be supported by individual subscriptions. Carey said, I'll go as the first missionary. And so they sent him. And he had a hard time getting a ship because of the hostility of the East India Company to any form of missionary work. They didn't want it to disturb their business. And finally, it was in June 1793 on a Danish vessel that he set sail for India. And his parting message to his friends at home was terse and impressive. And he used an image that referred to the mines in England. England had a lot of mines, and when the miners entered, they were always on the end of a long rope, and somebody was holding the rope so they wouldn't get lost in the mine. They could come out. And he said, yonder in India is a gold mine. I will descend and dig for souls, but you at home must hold the ropes. And so he went to India, spent 40 years in India as a missionary. And that Baptist Missionary Society, which he created with those pastors of poverty-stricken churches, has become the mechanism, the model for Protestant missionary activity ever since then. It was a reproducible model, and that's why we call him the father of modern missions. Carey was extraordinarily independent and modern in his outlook. He saw missionary work as a five-pronged advance with equal attention directed to each of five elements. Stephen Neal explains those elements in his book, A History of Christian Missions. First, and it's just amazing that here's this person, the first modern Protestant missionary, and he has a strategy that sounds just like it came out of the latest classes in missiology at the great missionary training institutions around the world. First, the widespread preaching of the gospel by every possible method. Second, the support of the preaching by the distribution of the Bible in the language of the country. And he himself devoted much labor to the translation of the scripture and the construction of dictionaries and grammars. Third, the establishment at the earliest possible moment of a church. Now that differed somewhat from the strategy of the Moravians. Fourth, a profound study of the background and thought of the non-Christian people. Fifth, the training at the earliest possible moment of an indigenous ministry. Now, this is the 1790s, and this is a remarkable up-to-date strategy that anyone would follow today and say this is the latest word in missionary strategy. The impact of what Carey did was enormous. In fact, William Carey has had a tremendous impact on the development of indigenous missionary enterprise within India. P.M. Thomas, who's the founder and president of the Kashmir Evangelical Fellowship, talks about the impact of William Carey on his life.
This man, William Carey, gave a great impact on my personal life. I was a school teacher first, and then the Lord spoke to me and called me. I read the lives of many missionaries. William Carey perhaps stands foremost in my life. As a young man working in a cobbler's shop, he made pieces of leather and made a map of the world with the leather pieces and used to pray for world evangelization. His main burden was towards India, and he used to pray for the millions perishing in India. He shared that burden with his church members and his church leaders. And one meeting, he could not control his emotions. He cried out and shouted, "Millions are going into hellfire in India, so we must do something to save them." The chairman of the mission of the meeting shouted and said, "Young men, you sit down there. When God wants to save India, he will have his own methods." But William Carey was not disappointed. He continued with his vision. I can only say that if God has given you a vision, he is able to keep it. And no power on earth can distract your vision. He continued, and he waited at the door of the church. People came and said goodbye to him. Some people did not even talk to him. Few people congratulated him. Towards the end, four people were left. And they were also saying goodbye and going. William Carey shouted and said, holding on to their hands with agony, "Friends, you said it is good, but what's it you are going to do about it?" They sat there, they prayed about it, and they emptied their purses into the center. The total came to 13 pounds and 5 shillings. That was the first asset of the Sarambur mission. Now with this great burden, he started his journey to India, came to Calcutta, and over there he started a great work, which today is spread all over East India now. And millions were touched because of him. Dictionaries were made in many Indian languages for the first time. I myself have seen Bibles in 18 Indian languages in the Sarambur Bible College. Could this almost illiterate young man bring such a great impact to the whole world? When I was coming out into missionary work, the Lord talked to me through the lives of several people. But William Curry's one statement touched me most. Expect great things from the Lord and attempt great things for God.
Curry was a tremendous inspiration, not only to people in India, but to people in the United States. Because at the time that Curry went to India and word of what he was accomplishing in India began to filter back, there were no missionary societies in the United States. There were no missionaries from the United States. The missionary movement was in Europe. But there were those within the United States who felt that the United States should be sending missionaries as well. It wasn't the senior pastors of the great churches. It was Christian college students among whom this burden developed. One person in particular stands out. His name is Samuel Mills. Samuel Mills was a student at Williams College in Massachusetts. And at that time in the history of the United States, it wasn't very popular to be a Christian in college. And so he and some of his fellow students who were Christians would go out into the woods where they couldn't be seen to pray about the beginning of a missionary movement in the United States. People in their teens, in their early 20s, had this vision of missions. And one time when they were out in the woods praying, they got caught in a thunderstorm and they fled under a haystack in order to keep dry, and they continued praying about the sending of missions. And finally Mills got to his feet and he said, "We can if we will." And they determined to begin a missionary movement in the United States. They were part of the Congregational Church, and so they prevailed upon the leadership of the Congregational Church to establish a missionary society similar to the one that Curry had established in England. They were afraid of offending their elders, so there were six people who signed the initial petition, but they erased a couple of the names, so it was only four people, and they wouldn't be seen as a bunch of young upstarts trying to upset the status quo. Well, it went to the meeting of the Congregational Churches, and they decided to refer it to a committee. That often happens in church meetings, but it was a good committee. And so out of that committee came the recommendation to establish a mission agency, and that mission agency was established in the year 1810, and it was called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. And this is the oldest U.S. society for foreign missions. In 1812, they sent their first missionary. His name was Adoniram Judson. And he was sent to India to join Curry. Adoniram Judson was the son of a preacher in Massachusetts. In fact, when he was just 5 and 6 and 7 years old, his father was teaching him to read the Bible in the Greek and Hebrew languages. He was a brilliant student, and he went to Brown University. But at Brown University, he lost his faith. He had a roommate by the name of Ernst, and Ernst was very much influenced by the ideas that were current in France, and he influenced Adoniram Judson, and Judson lost his Christian convictions. I heard Billy Graham tell the story of how Judson changed his mind about the gospel. Judson one day was riding horseback through New England. He stopped at an inn and he asked for a room. And the innkeeper said, "Well, there's only one room left, and it's next door to a man who's dying. He's making an awful racket, and I don't think you'll be able to sleep." Judson said, "Well, that really doesn't make any difference. Give me the room." So they took care of his horse, and he went up to the room. And during the night, he heard a voice in the next room. Sometimes it would ask God for mercy, and sometimes it was swearing and taking the name of God in vain. And then later in the night, the voice finally stopped, and Judson went to sleep. And the next morning he asked the innkeeper, "Well, what happened to the man in the room that was next to me last night?" The innkeeper said, "He died." "What was his name?" Judson asked. His name was Ernest. The innkeeper replied. This man had been Judson's roommate through college. He was the person who'd influenced him away from the Christian faith. And so Judson got on his horse, and every time the horse's hooves hit the ground, the words kept running through his mind. Dead, lost, dead, lost, dead, lost. And Judson turned around and went home. And he had a rebirth of his faith, and he went to Andover Seminary in Massachusetts, and he prepared for the ministry. And he was the first to volunteer to go out into the new society. You can go to the church today, and the pew is still there in the church where they commissioned Judson in Salem Church in Boston. In fact, at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, they take the students to the church where Judson grew up and then the church where he was set apart for ministry. And I went with them one time and we walked out right near the church. There's a pier that's still there, and you walk out to the end of the pier, and that's the pier from which Judson sailed for India. And when he sailed in 1812, the missionary movement in the United States was born. The United States had sent its first missionary and became a part of that great missionary movement. Following the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, there were an increasing number of missionary agencies that were established in the United States, all patterned after the sending agency that Carey had established in England. The building where the American Board was established in 1810 is still standing, and if you go there, you'll see the sign that says, "Here was founded the American Board, 1810. I had the privilege a few years ago of leading a communion service using the table, for the Lord's table, around which the founders of the American Board gathered. That table is still in use, and it's used often as a communion table for services in which missions is a theme. And so we see here the birth of modern missions.